Okay. Well, we'll proceed to absent counsel for appellant. This is the third of three oral arguments. We're appearing via the Zoom format. Judges Cochran and Larson join me, Judge Sleater, in this file A24-1141, Dale Zubke, respondent versus David Nelson et al., who are appellants. And we are recording this proceeding and as well as live streaming, and no other recording is allowed absent prior approval, and we will have the audio available on the Judicial Branch's website within 24 hours. We've not had an appearance. We're at 10:52. We're scheduled at 10:50 a.m. from counsel for appellant, so we generally presume that that means, absent any explanation ahead of time, that they've waived oral argument. We do have counsel Brian Lindsay, I believe, if I pronounce that correctly, and you represent the respondent, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, in light of that, you may, I guess, respond to the written arguments as opposed to oral arguments, Mr. Lindsay.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Generally, I was hoping to have some argument from Mr. Mathias to kind of take up some of my time. I left ample time for that, but I have submitted a brief. Primarily, I'll rely on that. I'm happy to take and would appreciate questions from the bench if there are any.
Can I just ask you, Mr. Lindsay, I'm assuming you haven't had any communication, at least within the last day or two, regarding today's oral argument from Mr. Mathias?
I have received no communication from him, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. So this is obviously.
Maybe I interrupt you again. Now we've got a note. Mr. Mathias is having problem with hearing, so I'm assuming he's, is he, do you know, Sue, is he on by phone? And the message was from Keith Carlson. And what I can't tell from the message, if he's having trouble hearing today or if he has a hearing concern, we haven't been made aware of that.
Judge, I'm wondering if he's having a trouble getting logged in. It looks like the message says with hearing. Maybe he's having a trouble logging in.
I assume that may be true, but apparently, Sue, he's not communicated with you, though, directly. Okay. Well, I think absent a little more detailed explanation, we'll continue with Mr. Lindsay. And if we learn something by the time you're done speaking or answering our questions, we might be creative. So you may continue, Mr. Lindsay.
Thank you, Your Honor. I apologize. Let me gather my thoughts here briefly. So primarily, I'll rely on my briefing. I think everything is well laid out there. I think there is some value in kind of taking a step back and looking at a high level overview of kind of how this case has proceeded, because over the last decade or so that the parties have been communicating and involved in litigation, as attorneys want to do, I think we've kind of bogged this whole thing down in the details. The critical piece to the case, which is before the court today, is a two-part agreement that was entered into between Mr. Zubke on the one hand and Mr. Nelson and two of the corporate entities on the other. And that was a resolution of some litigation that had actually gone up to the Court of Appeals following a judgment and been resolved. Essentially, the terms of the resolution were that Mr. Zubke was going to sell his interest in the business to Mr. Nelson upon specified terms. And they entered into essentially a purchase agreement for those shares and then a security agreement. And at the outset, things did not go as planned, and the security agreement required Mr. Nelson and the business entities, Northern Lights and Preferred Dealer Services, to accomplish certain tasks in order to provide security for my client, Mr. Zubke. Those tasks included transferring four properties that were identified on an Exhibit D to the agreement into the name of Northern Lights, so they would be under the control of the corporate entities or the business entities, and then to secure the properties or to secure Mr. Zubke's interest by executing and recording or placing of record a specific mortgage that protected Mr. Zubke. As the agreement moved forward, those two items were not accomplished. And I think clarifying some of the timelines is important because it becomes a little bit confusing or muddled in details in the underlying briefing. There was a reference at one point to the fact that the court made this decision and the agreement had been in place for only a year. Well, after 10 months in May of 2017, in May 1st of 2017, Mr. Zubke, through his then counsel, put Mr. Nelson and the business entities on notice that they were in default for failing to accomplish these required and simple tasks of placing the properties into the ownership of the business. And upon that notice, there was a 7-day period, which was defined in the contract, after which a default period began. Nobody disputes that that was accomplished. The litigation, during the course of the litigation, there were several arguments that, well, there are certain things that Mr. Zubke couldn't argue or couldn't bring forward because they essentially weren't no they weren't present within that notice of default. And it's clear that the notice of default creating a default period or a status under the contract is something that's wholly separate from the legal claims or the breach of contract claims that were asserted ultimately in the litigation.
Mr. Lindsay,
So,
I've got a sorry, Judge Cochran. I saw a message from Sue Siegel that he may now be available, and I thought we might just stop at 10:24. Okay, very well. Okay, thank you. We'll continue. Judge Cochran, you had a question.
I wanted to ask about paragraph 6 of the redemption and security agreement, and which seems to be the one of the pieces of default that was identified. And the district court found that the mortgage wasn't entered into, and that at least as of the time of the summary judgment hearing, two of the four properties hadn't been transferred. The title hadn't been put in the company name. Is that your understanding as well?
That is correct. That was part of our argument on the summary judgment.
So, and the reason for the transfer of the title and the mortgage was to ensure if the business went downhill, there was collateral to make payments with. Is that accurate?
That is absolutely accurate, Your Honor.
Okay. So, but at the time of the notice of default, that 10-month period, does the record reflect is there whether any of the four properties had been transferred, title had been transferred? Because it seems like the district court's finding is as of 2022, which is 6 years after the agreement was entered into. But I'm wondering about the timing of when the notice was given, 10 months after the agreement was entered into.
And before you answer that question, Mr. Lindsay, if you're able to, I see another message from Ms. Siegel that he is Keith Carlson, or Keith Carlson is actually him. And Sue, did I read that note correctly?
Okay, go ahead. Yes. I am finally here.
Oh, and you are Robert Mathias?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And have you been able to hear so far up to this point, Mr. Lindsay's comments?
Yeah, for the most part, yes.
Okay. Well, it's a bit unorthodox, but since we're kind of halfway through his comments and Judge Cochran just had a question, I think what we'll do is have Mr. Lindsay finish and then we'll turn to you for your 15 minutes.
Yeah, I just so that you understand, I have no intention of going back over the briefs that I filed. They're extensive
Sure.
enough and I think understandable. So I just have a few remarks that I would make and then be open
Okay.
for questions from your honors.
Okay. Well, if you just want to mute yourself for now, we'll have Mr. Lindsay continue. And I know, Mr. Lindsay, do you remember Judge Cochran's question?
I believe I do, Judge. Correct me if I misstate it. I think the question related to what was the status of the properties, the ownership, and the mortgage at the time of the notice of default back in May of 2020 or 2017. So I don't have the documents right in front of me. I can tell you that I can represent to the court that the properties had not been placed into the ownership of the company and the mortgages had not been secured. That fact was true both on the date that the default notice was given, and it was true on the date that the argument of the summary judgment motion occurred. And there was some property transfer in 2021 that did place two of the four properties into the proper name of Northern Lights. But in conjunction with that, in 2021, there was also a $338,000 mortgage that encumbered both or two of the four properties. And that was another allegation. It's a fact that was established by without any dispute within the public records. The mortgage shows up on the index search and as a recorded document encumbering those properties. That occurred in 2021 in violation, we argue, in violation of that redemption and security agreement, because the consent of Mr. Zubke was not obtained in placing that. So there were some dates where activity occurred, but at least two of those properties were never transferred into the name of Northern Lights. And more specifically, one of the property transfers that occurred in 2021 relative to the property located at 6132 East Superior Street, which was identified in Exhibit Z. D, which was intended and supposed to be placed into the name of Northern Lights, was actually transferred into the name of Mr. Nelson individually in direct violation of the redemption and security agreement. And so those were kind of the dates and events, but it is true that not all of the steps had been accomplished as of November or May of 2017, and two of the four properties had not been transferred, had any of their interest transferred into the name of Northern Lights as of the hearing on the motion in 2022. And so that timing is important there.
Thank you. Judge Slater, is it your intent that Mr. Lindsay would finish his time and then we would go to Mr. Mathias, or are we stopping and going to Mr. Mathias? I'm a little unclear on how we're proceeding here.
More of the former, I thought, since we were over halfway into Mr. Lindsay's
Okay.
comments, and Mr. Mathias did say he was able to hear. I thought we'd finish with Mr. Lindsay and then turn back to Mr. Mathias.
Okay, well then perhaps we could give Mr. Lindsay some additional time given
Sure,
the orthodox approach here, but
right. It'll be kind of a reverse rebuttal sort of a scenario.
yeah, I don't know. I mean, I leave that to you as the presiding judge, but so then, Mr. Lindsay, in your view, is paragraph six of the agreement ambiguous or unambiguous as to timing?
Judge, there, candidly, I think on Mr. Zubke's behalf, we have to acknowledge that there is no stated timeline within that paragraph. The
Is the
question.
expectation, though, that given the reason for this agreement, that performance would occur, and if it was didn't occur, then a default notice could be provided, and there was a 7-day period to cure?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And as I briefed, and I won't get into it extensively, there was guidance provided at other places within the security, the RSA, which provided that certain other activities had to occur within 60 days. And I think that's that gives, to the extent that it's ambiguous as to timing, I think that gives a pretty good idea of the timelines that the parties had in mind as they were drafting. And absent any of that guidance, there is the standard rule within Minnesota that when there is no stated timeline, a time to perform is a reasonable time. And I can't state with certainty, but it would be hard for me to believe that there was no communication between the parties in the 10 months between the signature being placed on the agreement and the May notice of default. And in addition, Judge or panel, the notice of default, as I had indicated, when there is no stated timeline and when you have that kind of that reasonableness term, one of the things that can be a guiding principle is, was there ever a demand for performance? And I've argued in the brief, and I'll take the position during my oral argument as well, I would take the position on behalf of Mr. Zupke that the notice of default was a demand for performance, as was the filing of the lawsuit a demand for performance. And especially when we get to the timelines that start to look like the filing of the lawsuit or the even the hearing of the summary judgment, we've got more than approximately 6 years worth of time in which no performance had been rendered to satisfy the requirements. And at that point, I don't think it could, reasonable minds could differ to say, well, maybe there was no timeline. And to follow appellant's argument to its logical conclusion, Mr. Nelson and Northern Lights could have finalized these transactions the day before the contract was to end, and that's patently unreasonable. The purpose of security and the purpose of kind of shoring up the debts was expressed within that security aspect of that agreement, which was in a security agreement, it's the primary focus of the agreement. I understand Mr. Nelson's argument that these payments were made on a monthly basis and there was no default in the payments. But the contract, the essential essence of the contract was two parts. One was the payments, and one was to provide security for the payments for the long-term life of the performance of the contract.
Mr. Lindsay, yeah. Can I ask you, in terms of the interest rate, the calculation, am I accurately summarizing your client's position that the reason there's no genuine issue of material fact is there was no opposing evidence in terms of the amortization that your client submitted, which calculated the difference between the 6% that had been paid and then the 10%. And so am I understanding it correctly that none of that calculation was duplicative of the monthly payments plus 6% that had already been received?
You're absolutely correct, Your Honor. The calculation, the amortization schedule that was supplied upon the court's request following the motion for summary judgment, it reevaluated the totality of that financial expense. It did not add the additional 10% interest for the default period until after that default period had been established after May 8th of 2017. And on each monthly basis, it credited back to the account of Mr. Nelson the payments that were received. So that calculation took into account all of the payments that were made. It's just, unfortunately, because of the default period, that those payments were not keeping up with the interest.
Thank you.
And so, essentially, that time period, we do take the position that the default period was properly entered into. And when we step back a little bit further, that reasonable minds really can't differ because performance had been demanded several times. And even though there's not this a specific date that it has to be done by you know, May 30th or June 2nd, a reasonable time had long since lapsed at the time that the notice had been given for default and also when the case was filed. And surely it had by the time that the motion for summary judgment had been heard. And so when you look at it in that regard, it's clear that that there was a default and there was a breach as to those things that were shown clearly by the public records and demonstrated to the court. With that, Judge, perhaps I could retain 5 minutes for rebuttal following
Well,
this objection.
it makes sense in this unorthodox method that we're proceeding that we'll do that in case there's some response you have to appellant's argument. And so, Mr. Bathias, we'll have you. You'll have 15 minutes. I do ask that you identify yourself because we are recording the proceeding and whom you represent, and then you can begin your comments.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is Robert Mathias, M-A-T-H-I-A-S, representing the appellants, David Nelson and the three LLCs that are identified in the pleadings. Actually, there's only two LLCs in existence. The preferred dealership was terminated when the agreement was made back in 2016, and it's still on the title, but it's not an ongoing LLC. Let me start out and I'll just respond as best I can to the argument that's just been made. What has to be acknowledged and remembered is that within 1 year of the agreement that was made by respondent, his then attorney, Mr. Nelson, and the receiver at that time, Mr. Bartholomew, they sat down and worked out this agreement. I did not represent Mr. Nelson at the time, so he did not have the advice of an attorney, but the respondent did. Given those facts, they hacked out this R&S agreement as well as the agreement itself, and there was no time limit stated at all in paragraph 6. And so when I look at that originally, and as I look at it now, I say to myself, why would anyone do that? And the answer is, I don't know. But they sat down and looked at the situation that existed at the time, and that is the agreement they made. If you look at paragraph 10 of the agreement, my client was required to pay $357,000 to take the respondent's name off a number of obligations. Again, there's no time limit specified there either. And so I think one can conclude that the parties believed that everyone would act in good faith and would do what the contract said.
Well, counsel, the agreement does provide that identifies when a default occurs, and a default exists if there's a failure to perform any of the obligations, and then there's a 7-day period to cure. And paragraph 6 also provides that the companies in Nelson shall take all necessary action to title the property identified in Exhibit D in the name of Northern and to effectuate the mortgages. So reading those two together, and given the purpose of this agreement, is it necessary for there to be a time period to transfer title and enter into the mortgage, given that there's a 7-day cure period? In other words, the agreement contemplates that your clients would take all necessary steps to get this done. But if Mr. Zupke determined that it hadn't been done, he could, and they were in default, he could give them notice. They would then have 7 days to correct that. And if they didn't, then the remedies would be available. Why is that not a reasonable interpretation of the contract?
Well, I think if you look at the affidavit that Mr. Nelson filed in opposition, I think it's a date of 2023, he sets forth in detail the reason why the properties weren't transferred as the agreement required.
Well, Mr. Mathias, I did look at the affidavit. What was the date of the one you just mentioned?
It's the affidavit, I think, of in 2023.
Well, 2023 would be after the district court heard the summary judgment motion. That wasn't the affidavit that was filed in response to the summary judgment motion.
Yeah, he filed one
response to the
as
summary
well.
judgment. So that's what's relevant to us here is any affidavits filed in response to the summary judgment motion, not after.
Well, you have to remember, Your Honor, this case was in the judge's hands for 5.5 years.
Well, I still haven't heard your answer to why my understanding of the agreement, whether that's a reasonable interpretation or not.
I think it was filed in opposition to the second motion for summary judgment, that is dismissing all of Mr. Nelson's counterclaims.
Okay, but well, let's turn to the district court's findings then in terms of the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment, Mr. Zubke's motion for summary judgment on his claims. The district court found that in 2022, so 6 years after the agreement was entered into, that two of the properties still had not been transferred into Northern's name and that the mortgage hadn't been executed. Why is 6 years not a reasonable period of time for that those actions to be taken?
Well, I think his initial answer is the correct one, and that is the contract doesn't require it. And
so your view is that that performance is never required then?
Well, that was his initial position, and I think that was the correct position because.
But doesn't that render the language meaningless?
I'm sorry?
Well, if performance is never required, doesn't that render the language of paragraph 6 meaningless?
I
in
can't.
In other words, the requirement that they take all necessary action to title the real property in the name of Northern?
Yeah, well, I can't answer that other than to say that it has taken place. The properties have been moved.
Well, there's at least one is still in Nelson's name, according to the documents filed with the district court.
I can't answer that. I don't know the answer to that. All as I know is what actually happened. What actually happened was there was no time limit. The properties within the 12-year period of the contract were all transferred except for one, which the respondent refuses to transfer even to this day. And so as a consequence, there are plenty of fact questions as to why the properties weren't moved when they were.
Well, counsel, with regard to the 6132 East Superior Street property, the records in the district courts from the district court filed with relating to the summary judgment motion show that that property is in the name of Mr. Nelson. Do you dispute that is what the evidence shows?
That's what the evidence shows, yes.
So it's not in Mr. Zupke's name, it's in Mr. Nelson's name.
So what? I'm sorry.
What I'm saying is, I think you were arguing that there's one property that hasn't been transferred and it's in Mr. Zupke's name. But the district court found that there were two properties that hadn't been transferred, one of which is 6132 East Superior Street, and that is in Mr. Nelson's name.
Yeah, the one that's not transferred is the High Street property.
But what evidence is there that the 6132 East Superior Street property was transferred to Northern as required by paragraph 6?
The evidence is the affidavits filed by Mr. Nelson.
I don't see an affidavit that says that piece of property or any property record showing that was actually transferred to Nelson.
That's the 2023 affidavit.
But that was after the district court decided the summary judgment motion.
But let me ask you this question. Does not the district court under Rule 5202 or 5901, or as a general matter, of course, have the capacity and the power and the authority to do whatever it wants until there's a final judgment. Those rules of law seem to, or I said rules of practice, seem to say that to me. And so whether the affidavit was filed in 2023 in response to the second motion for summary judgment or in response to the first, it's still a part of the case. It's still a part of the record. And the judge has the opportunity to look at all those documents before a final judgment has been rendered, which was rendered in June of 2024. And so all the evidence was there, and all the judge had to do was look at it. Now, the fact is that the judge based his decision by saying that the respondent's security had been impaired. There's absolutely no evidence of that in the entire record, not one iota of evidence. And yet that's what buttresses the judgment for $1 million, almost $300,000 to this day. And so our position has been from the beginning, the judge made the wrong decision in the beginning, but nevertheless, there are numerous fact questions out there that need to be answered by a jury and not by a judge. We asked for a jury trial initially, and we were turned down three or four times by the judge at the last minute, and then he finally eliminated a jury trial from the whole picture. This case could have been decided in less than a year, and it took 5.5 years for a judge to make a decision. And basically, there are fact questions all over. We have raised them in our affidavits, and we would hope that the court would follow its prior rulings and see that this case needs to be resolved other than by a ruling by the judge, which was, in our opinion, totally off the wall.
Back Very well. I was just going to say, Mr. Mathias, wish to conclude?
Just one more thing, and I don't want this to be overlooked. My client really had about three things to do under the original contract, but the main thing was to pay the respondent $1,100,000. My client has paid the respondent well over $1 million as we sit here today, and yet the judge does not want to give him any credit for that at all. And so it seems to me that, and we would ask the court to take a look at what the initial obligations were. And the question is, did my client do his best to meet them? But more than that, are there fact questions that need to be resolved here? And the fact is, there are a lot of them, we believe.
Very well. I see no other questions, Mr. Mathias. And so we'll continue in an unorthodox fashion and turn to the respondent in 5 minutes. Any responses you wish to make, Mr. Lindsay?
Your Honors, I really have nothing more to add other than I think the case law supports our position. And we would ask the court to simply send this case back on remand to resolve whatever factual issues remain. There are factual issues who've been raised by this respondent since 2012, and I don't think they're going to stop today. And so if the case goes back for a jury trial, I think we're going to get everything resolved in less than 5.5 years.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mathias. Mr. Lindsay, you'll have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate the additional time. So I just wanted to clarify a couple of things so the record is clear. As I heard Mr. Mathias speaking, counsel, candidly speaking, there have been transfers to the property, and I believe there's been more movement towards compliance, but those facts and events happened well after the summary judgment motion was entered. And I think that entering of the summary judgment motion is a critical piece because when we step back and look at it, at that point, what the court determined was on the record, there was no material issues of fact related to the fact that there had been a breach of the security terms of the agreement, and the court reduced what was due and owing under the contract at that point with the application of the default period to a judgment. And so those huge amounts did not continue to accrue after that point. The contract was essentially eliminated because there was a finding that it had been material and wholly breached, and the judgment was awarded. Just to speak very briefly to, and we take the position that the award of that judgment was appropriate and did take into account the payments that Mr. Nelson had made throughout the course. And as I step back, I'd be remiss not to indicate through the course of this, and I think it becomes clear as the record is reviewed, the performance by Mr. Nelson was a selective kind of performance. Mr. Nelson made the payments and tried to use the fact that the payments were being made as a shield to try to defend against the material breaches as to the other material and critical aspects of the contracts, specifically as they related to those security terms. And that selective performance was not adequate. There was very specific and detailed items that needed to be accomplished. There was no question, based on the record before the court at the initial summary judgment, that those things were not accomplished. So the judgment was entered, and all credit has been given to Mr. Nelson for amounts that he's paid. As it relates to counterclaims that were contained within the pleadings were essentially a list of allegations, not really broken down into counts and theories, but just statements. And so one of the issues that the court was confronted with was basically distilling down what the essence or what the actual claims were that were being made by those allegations. And the court was able to do that. And as the court broke it down, a large thrust of what the argument was that Mr. Zubke was acting in bad faith or somehow hindering the business by asking questions or by seeking additional information, or that Mr. Zubke was causing harm to the business by not agreeing to authorize the issuance of additional debt and loans, which ultimately were accomplished in any event in 2021 with the acquisition and encumbrance of the properties that should have been in the company by this $338,000 mortgage. But the nature of those claims is examined, Mr. Zubke had an interest in the business, and it was not bad faith that he asked questions to try to gather information to learn more about what the status and what was going on. This was essentially his livelihood at this point, was to be reimbursed for the payment of his interest in the business. And the fact that he did not give authority or did not grant permission for additional funding or additional debt to be placed against the business, that was a right that was reserved to Mr. Zubke in the agreements by everybody. And so the fact that those things occurred did not constitute anything that was actionable by Mr. Nelson. It was Mr. Zubke just exercising his rights and obligations under the contract. Unfortunately, it was in a way that Mr. Nelson didn't agree with or didn't approve of, but those were his rights. And as the record is examined, that's essentially what the court found, is that Mr. Zubke was doing simply following his diligence, performing diligence and ensuring that he was going to be repaid, which is additional support for the fact that these security aspects of the agreement were critical to Mr. Zubke. $1 million and $1.1 million is a lot of money to be paid, and he had a right to ask and to demand that the security be kept in place.
Judge Cochran, did you have a question?
I'm wondering if you can address the 2023 affidavit, the argument that Mr. Mathias was making related to that.
Thank you, Your Honor. I apologize to the court. I don't have that affidavit right in front of me, and I know that I'm technically out of time, but I will respond to the question. My recollection is that affidavit did talk about some property transfers, but those were things that happened after the fact. They were events that occurred after the summary judgment. And candidly, on Mr. Zubke's behalf, we don't dispute that as we sit here today, the ownership of the properties is different. But during the course of this litigation and until the summary judgment issued, Mr. Nelson essentially applied or adhered
so
to the portion.
The, Is the relevant time period for purposes of Mr. Zubke's affirmative motion for summary judgment on his claims, is it up till the time the district court heard the motion, or is it the, you know, when the notice of default was given? What is the relevant time period, or is it post that period, as Mr. Mathias would suggest, post the decision time, 2020?
Thank you, Your Honor. For if on Mr. Zubke's behalf, the relevant time periods are, I think the notice and creation of the default period was important. As it relates to the actual, the finding of no material issues in the grant of summary judgment, I think the critical time period is 2016, when the contract was entered into, until the date of the argument of the oral argument. I think that's the critical time period. After the court's decision was issued on the summary judgment, theoretically that contract went away because it had been determined to be materially breached. The court had issued a judgment in Mr. Zubke's behalf, which collection of that judgment will satisfy Mr. Zubke. And so I think that that is the critical time period. I note that the default period is an important time period because that was a date that came after the formation of the contract, but was within Mr. Zubke's right to provide that notice because the things hadn't been done, and to create that special status starting 7 days after that notice had been given. But as far as the transfer or coming into compliance with the agreement, after the court had heard the motion for summary judgment and was preparing and issuing its decision, all of the events, the fact that Mr. Mathias may have made moves toward, not completely into, but made moves toward compliance after the fact, isn't relevant. The court had its record established and was able to make its decision based on the record that it had before it for the performance over the 6 years from the date prior to the formation of the contract.
Very well. Thank you to both counsel. We've successfully stumbled to the end of our third of three oral arguments. We appreciate your answers to our questions and your briefing, and we will now take the matter under advisement. And this is our final of three, as I indicate, so we will be adjourning. You each have a good day.
You as well, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.